Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vassilash, episode 373 for April 13th of 2017. All you want to know about the New York Auto Show. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Welcome to Autoline After Hours from the New York Auto Show. Gary, kind of cool to be on the road with the show.
Indeed. Second year in a row, here we are in the Toyota stand.
Yet again. In fact, we've got a great show coming up today. We've got a number of people that are here at the show. In fact, joining us right now is Bill Fay. He's the Vice President of Automotive Operations for Toyota Motor Sales. Bill, welcome to the show.
Afternoon, guys. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Great to have you.
Yeah.
So one of the big announcements that Toyota had today was this concept vehicle, the FT4X.
Yep.
I'll learn it before it's over. But it's a cool-looking vehicle. Tell us a little bit about it and why you're introing it at this show.
Yeah, it's a concept. So hopefully we get a lot of great feedback here at the New York show and can kind of push the green light and the company to build it. But it's an entry-level sport utility vehicle. It'll have a great entry-level price point. We've just launched the CHR, but this could be a little bit more of a versatile vehicle. Think CHR around the city. FT4X maybe goes out to Montauk or, you know, has a little bit more of an active lifestyle geared towards the younger crowd, the millennials. But we think that there's enough breadth in the market and enough activity there that we could handle these two vehicles. So we're hopeful we get some great feedback in New York, and we then use that to go back to the company and say that we think this is a viable product, and let's build it.
So CHR is more coupe-like in its overall design than this new concept vehicle you guys are showing. So looking to sort of attract a buyer that would be more interested in the outdoorsiness without going over the top with that.
Yeah, just having a little bit more utility, a little bit more versatility. We show it as an all-wheel drive vehicle. So I think just the younger generation that wants to do a little bit more with the vehicle versus drive it around Manhattan and have some fun in the five boroughs, they might want to go take a little bit more of a trip out into the woods, do a little camping, a little outdoor activity. So we think there's a role there for another vehicle, especially with this whole utility body craze that consumers have today in today's market.
And this was designed at Kelty in California.
It was. It's designed by our Kelty studio. They've done some great work. They did the LC Coupe that's going to be on sale here soon for Lexus. They originally did our FJ Cruiser, which, you know, has had some phenomenal success. So, you know, they've done some great work for us, and they designed us.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious how you use an auto show to determine the viability of whether a concept should go into production or not. I love this thing. I would just say, go build it right now. But I'm not sure you can build a business case around my enthusiasm. How do you really measure this where you go, oh, we're so close, but no, we can't pull the trigger? What's the tipping point when you say, yeah, let's go to management and really get this into the plants and rolling down the assembly lines?
Well, the first thing is we get, you know, some feedback from you all, the media. So I think that's always good feedback, what your impressions are, how you report the vehicle and everything. And then we got a whole week here plus of, you know, consumer feedback of people coming through the show, you know, what their feedback is relative to the footprint and the looks and the utility and the interior components, ingress, egress, usability, price point. So we get some real world feedback, and then we kind of plug that into what's the market doing, how are we situated in the market, and I think that gives us a real good base to then go to the parent company, say that, you know, here's what we think we can do with this vehicle. Are there some global capabilities with it that, you know, maybe we could build it here and export it somewhere? And so that really gets us into that next level of analysis. And hopefully it's all positive and we go through each gate. And as a sales guy, I'm hoping we get to the point where, you know, we press the light and we say, let's develop it and build it here.
Well, speaking of sales, I mean, the RAV4 is doing phenomenally well. And so that whole smaller SUV crossover segment is doing great. So you guys, you know, as you mentioned, you have the CHR, but it's not immediately perceived as being a crossover vehicle. So this thing seems to me to be like right in the sweet spot of the market.
I would agree. And both CHR and something like this, if we green light it and brought it to market, really has a lower, more affordable entry price point. So where we transact probably 24,000-ish on RAV4, maybe 25, this would be several thousand lower. So it's really going to appeal to entry-level buyers, buyers that are looking a little bit more at their finances, but offers great utility to be able to do a lot more than with the vehicle, has different styling than CHR, maybe not quite as initially appealing, but it's got all kinds of, you know, ways to use the vehicle and a lot of diverse things that you can do with it and a lot of interior appointments and components that are pretty unique to it. So, you know, very excited to be able to consider bringing this to market at a lower price point.
You had the FJ Cruiser, which is kind of reminiscent of this vehicle. I think a lot of people will look at it and think, oh, this is the next step from the FJ Cruiser. I know towards the end of its life, sales really took a nosedive. But somebody just on the floor told me that the resale value on those vehicles is phenomenal.
It's probably got the best resale value of any product we have right now, and we don't build it anymore. So it's held up incredibly well.
Why is that?
I think it was just a real iconic vehicle that people really liked. And because we're not building it anymore and there's still some demand, people are willing to pay the price for it, and that keeps the values very high.
That's got to be another indicator to maybe give the green light to this concept.
We'll add that to the list.
Okay.
I like that, John.
Well, you know, I mean, one thing that maybe people don't realize is that Toyota has a long, strong history in vehicles of this type. Yeah. So perhaps that speaks to the resale value and the popularity of, you know, you've got the 4Runner and... Yep. You've got the Land Cruiser, and so robust vehicles.
I think cars help make the brand here, especially in the U.S. You know, Camry, Corolla, Prius, and what that's done. But really, there's some real DNA in our trucks, the heritage, especially the body-on-frame trucks that we've sold and have been very durable and very popular with consumers. So I think, you know, one of the strengths of Toyota is we have a great balance there. Even when markets shift a bit, we are well-positioned in both. But I think we do have some great DNA that goes back into our trucks and our pickup trucks that... would help a vehicle like this if we pressed the button and brought it to production.
Bill, as you said, you're the sales guy. Aren't you worried about how passenger cars keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking in the market, or does that not worry you?
Well, it's really just a shift in consumer preference, right? So I would worry if they're going away and trading their cars and not buying anything, but they're moving from cars into these utility body vehicles and pickup trucks. So... we, like everybody else, has made our adjustments. We're, you know, have a much more vibrant production schedule to support that. But cars, as I mentioned, are still a very important part of our business. Camry and Corolla are number one, number three selling cars in America through the first quarter. So I think it's really just a shift in customer preference that we're all reacting to. When they start shifting and not buying anymore, then we'll all start to worry because we're going to have different challenges. But I think this is a good challenge, and it provides a good opportunity for the industry to react to that.
And you've got a new Camry that will be coming out this year, and you guys clearly put a lot of more shape into that sheet metal to make it more appealing to perhaps customers that are on the fence?
We launched it in Detroit. We had a great reception to it. We've been getting a great reception ever since, you know, 8th generation Camry. So we're really excited. It's on our new platform, which allows us to really change the whole car from the sheet metal to the interior to the suspension, the engine, the transmission, latest in technology and safety. So it's going to be a compelling story once we start marketing. It's going to be a great value. And we hope that it'll take some people that are outflowing to utility body vehicles and maybe get them to think twice about staying in the passenger car family.
There's a lot of stories out there right now. Oh, woe is the industry. Sales are slowing down. They are down slightly for the first quarter. What's your outlook for the year? Where do you think it's going to end up?
We're still very positive. We think that, you know, there's a bit of a leveling off here, but leveling off at near historic high levels. And if we can level off and stay there for 20 or 30 years, I think we'd all be fantastically happy about that. Now, it probably won't last for 20 or 30 years, but our feeling is if we can level off here at a very high level, that's very healthy for the industry. It's good for consumers because they're going to have great choices and great deals. It's great for us manufacturers to plan to that so that we're not overbuilding and then having to over-incentivize and add a lot of cost to our business. We're in a very good place. We're very optimistic that it's going to be a very, very strong year. Maybe not quite as strong as last year's record, but above 17 million and a very strong industry year.
That's a nice number to plateau out at, 17 million. That's pretty good.
It is.
Bill Fay, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with Gary and I. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Gary. Great to be here.
Stay tuned, folks. We got a lot more coming to you from the New York Auto Show, but right now we got to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Bridgestone engineers are helping All-Pro receiver Larry Fitzgerald go long.
I don't need help going long.
Bridgestone's Dura Lenza Plus is our longest-lasting SUV and truck tire. It's engineered to go 80,000 miles.
Huh? It's over 14 million first downs.
Oh, dang. I love anything that goes long. Long hair, long passes, long careers.
Long division.
Long dogs.
We're going to do this for 80,000 miles?
You can walk if you like.
I don't want to walk, Larry.
You don't have to.
Yes.
Long hugs, long weekends.
We're back from the floor of the New York Auto Show. And Gary, we got a new guest with us right now. It's the magic of being able to change things in and out. We've got Randy Parker. He's the Vice President of Infiniti for the Americas. And welcome to the show, Randy.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So New York, big, big market for a company like Infiniti.
Absolutely. New York is actually one of our largest markets in the country. Very important for the brand. We sell one out of every five Infinities in the U.S. in the New York Metroplex. So you can imagine this is a very important market for us.
Randy, why so popular in this area?
Well, the dealers have embraced the brand for a very, very long time. And it's a big car market for us. And our cars such as the Q50 do quite well here.
You've got a concept that you're showing at the show, right? QX80?
Yeah, we actually call it the QX80 Monograph. So it's a design study. And we'll give you a glimpse of what our future SUVs potentially could look like.
It's also got the biggest exhaust tips in the history of the automotive industry.
Yeah, I agree. And it's got a big grille as well. So, yeah it's got a huge commanding presence. It's beautifully designed and executed. And like I said, I think it's going to give you kind of a glimpse to what our future models could look like.
It's also sort of a more upright, hard-edged kind of vehicle, not smooth and flowing like so much of what we've seen coming out of Infiniti lately.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of effort that went into the design of that vehicle. But if you look very closely, you'll see that there's a history of Infiniti that you'll see, especially in the front part of the grille. It speaks Infiniti in volumes.
No, I would agree. Even without badges, if I looked at the grille, I'd say, oh, that's got to be an Infiniti.
Absolutely.
And I've also noticed over the years that when you see parts of a design that are overemphasized, like the exhaust tips I was talking about, or you mentioned the grille. Mm-hmm. The designers want you, they're deliberately drawing your eye to that feature.
Absolutely.
And it's usually something maybe not quite as exaggerated that does end up in production.
That's exactly right. But what we're trying to gauge right now with that car is to make sure that the consumers gravitate to it. So far we've gotten really good press on it today. But if we go in that direction, what you'll see driving down the highway, what we want you to see is that when you look in the rearview mirror, you're going to see this commanding, you know, front grille looking at you, right, with these really nasty eyeballs. And then, of course, when the car goes past you, which, you know, at that point you're happy that it does drive past you, right, you're going to see this huge exhaust that you just talked about behind you. So that's part of the element, you know, to make sure that, hey, when you look at it from the rearview mirror, it kind of scares you when you look at it. And then when you see it going past you, you go, wow.
So Randy, 1 out of 5 in the tri-state area here,
yes,
of your sales. Mm-hmm. And what types of vehicles are you selling mainly in this area?
This is a huge sedan market for us.
Really?
So yeah, it really is. So we do very well with our Q50, but not to be outdone, you know, we've seen a huge shift in the marketplace from sedans to crossovers and SUVs. And so right now our SUVs have really started to take off in this area as well. So for example, the new QX50 that we launched a little bit over a year ago, where we extended the wheelbase by 3 inches, you now have 4 inches of additional legroom in the back seat. It's now a user-friendly crossover. We were selling less than 200 a month initially, but once we went through that redesign and we repositioned the car, we're selling now over 1,200 a month, and a big portion of that is being done right here in the New York Metroplex.
Very interesting. Of course, Infiniti was blessed by having a guy named Alfonso Albaiza,
yes,
as its head of design. In fact,
yes,
he was so good he got promoted to do all design for Nissan. So I'm hoping you're going to keep that kind of momentum going that he started.
Absolutely. You know, if you look at the body of work that Alfonso has been able to produce over the last few years, I mean, it's just been exceptional. I've got mad respect for the guy. He's, in my opinion, one of the greatest designers on the planet. And to be quite honest with you, we're lucky to have him.
So, Randy, tell us what you think the distinction is between Infiniti and the other luxury marks that you're up against in.
Well, I think we're talking about it. To be quite honest with you, I mean, when you look at our portfolio, the brand itself from a design standpoint is very daring. You know, when I first got into the automobile industry, there was always something different about the Infiniti brand. And looking back at it now, I realize it was the design. And to me, that's a part of our brand heritage. It's part of our DNA, and it's something that, you know, I don't think we're going to ever want to change, right? We don't want to be a Me Too brand. But we really want to be very, very bold and daring in our design, as well as performance, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the biggest differentiator that we have in the marketplace is our design. And here, Alfonso, for example, is a big part of that, a big reason why.
Very much so.
Yep.
Your title is Vice President Infiniti Americas.
Correct.
I didn't realize that the Infiniti brand goes beyond the U.S. market alone.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm responsible for the sales and the operations of the Infiniti brand, not only in the U.S., but for Canada, Mexico, and Latin America as well, believe it or not. I stretch all the way as far south as Chile. We do have a distributor in Chile. So we've got about 40-plus dealers in Canada that do quite well, and we've got about a dozen dealers in Mexico that have just started to really, really ramp up and complement our Nissan portfolio in Mexico.
So that's relatively new, Mexico and Latin America, for the brand?
What we call an emerging market for us. And so they're setting all kinds of records, of course, you know, but the Nissan portfolio does extremely well in Mexico, and now the Infiniti brand is starting to take off.
Is it the same sort of SUV growth in that market, or are they more interested in sedans?
Right now, I would say that it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. The Q50 does extremely well there, as well as the QX60 does extremely well. Those are probably the two biggest sellers that we have in Mexico right now. And we just started to launch the all-new QX30 in Mexico as well. And so that car now is starting to gain some traction. Right now it's a little bit of everything in Mexico. You know, Mexico, the market is so big and so vast that we haven't seen that shift as much from sedans to crossovers and SUVs like we have here in the U.S. So
Infiniti is a global brand. It's not just an Americas brand.
Correct.
When you're talking to your colleagues that are in Europe and elsewhere in the world, I mean, are you all sort of finding the same thing, that there is this transition that the luxury market is going more towards the SUV?
No, it's completely different. I mean, the European market is completely different than the U.S. market. I mean, for example, I mean, you're not going to see a QX80 traveling down the streets of the Champs-Élysées, let's say, okay? I mean, it's just not going to happen. It doesn't make sense. So, but cars like our Q50 and QX30 do really well in other parts of the world. But, you know, to your point, in the Middle East, our QX80 performs extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just different. You know, each market is very different.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing so much action in the luxury market and so many other brands trying to get in. yourselves, Acura, Lincoln's trying to make a comeback, Cadillac, Volvo's aspiring to be in that space, Hyundai's just launched Genesis. How do you deal with this? I mean, what's your strategy to make sure you carve out your portion of it?
Yeah, good question. You know what? We just try to be the best that we can be. You know, this past year we sold just shy of 150,000 units here in the U.S. Our sales were up a little bit over 13% year over year. And we grew share in this market. As you just indicated, it's a very, very competitive market. But you know what? I think we're very well positioned because of our product portfolio. At the end of the day, we're in the business of selling cars. And nothing happens in this world until we sell our first car. And right now, I think we got a pretty strong portfolio to compete.
So is the LA market a big market for you guys?
Absolutely. That's our second largest market.
Second largest, yeah.
So New York is number one, and LA is number two. And LA also represents probably the largest growth opportunity that we have for the brand as well.
Why? Why do you say that?
Well, the market out there is really growing. And it's a very complex market because here we do, you know, great with sedans, but there we've got a bigger, I think, SUV and crossover opportunity. So we've got to perform a little bit better on the West Coast. But it's a growth market for us, and it's a huge opportunity simply because of the base. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a huge, huge market, and you know, we want to tap into that market. So,
what's your outlook for plug-in hybrids? Battery electrics? Nissan's one of the leaders in the world. Of course, that's the parent company for Infiniti. Where do you see that going, especially in the luxury segment?
Well, we were the pioneers when it came to EV vehicles, as you just indicated. And as you know, we're part of the Nissan-Renault alliance. And so going forward, you're going to see a huge, even bigger presence in the EV market for us. I can't tip my hand too much right now because I probably would get in trouble. But just know that we've got some things in the works and some things that I think... Are going to do very well in that space.
How about autonomous technology? You guys looking into that?
Autonomous technology? Yeah, we've already indicated as part of the alliance that we'll have 10 cars that I think by 2020 will have autonomous drive.
Mm-hmm. And that would be a level 3? You're not talking no steering wheel or anything
like
that?
Yeah, we're talking, you know, autonomous, what we call AD1, right? Which is more about, you know, being able to stay in a single lane and at the same time change lanes when you need to. So, and then we're talking about frontal and, you know, collision prevention, that type of thing. So, but yeah, it goes from 1, 2, and 3 in terms of the development time frame. But yeah, by 2020, 10 cars in the Alliance portfolio will have autonomous drive.
And how many of those will be Infinities?
That I can't tell you.
Stay tuned, right?
Stay tuned.
I had to ask.
I appreciate you asking.
What else? Are we missing anything?
No, this is it. I appreciate you guys having me on the show. You know, your show has always been big for me over the past 25 years of being in the auto industry. So it's just it's a pleasure for me to be here today. So thank you. Thanks for having me.
Randy Parker, real pleasure to having you
thank
on
you.
The show.
Thank you.
Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to show you one of those 37-second car reviews that we've been doing. We'll be back with more to talk about from the New York Auto Show.
This is 37 Seconds in the Autoline Garage. With so many upgrades, Mazda CX-5 compact SUV seems like a brand new car rather than a major refresh. Yes, there's a few exterior design tweaks and a red concept car paint option, but inside, engineers made a stiffer vehicle with a number of new seals to increase the quiet. Added soft touch materials paired with Apple CarPlay for an upgraded interior experience, rear doors that open wider, rear seats that fold flat for the first time, and the rear hatch that finally gets a power liftgate. Add to that the new software for better driving dynamics, and Mazda CX-5 should be a major player in the compact SUV segment. This has been 37 Seconds in the Autoline Garage.
We're back from the floor of the New York Auto Show, and joining us right now is David Woodhouse, the head of design for the Lincoln Motor Company. And thanks for joining Gary and I here on After Hours.
No, good to be here, John. Thank you.
So last year when we were at the show, you guys showed the concept for the Navigator. Now we're seeing the production car, and I got to say, it looks very close to what we saw last year. How did you do that?
I think we've done a good job over the last 3 years of showing concepts and following them up a year later with the production. And I mean, sometimes we know what we're doing in production, and we try and exaggerate that in the concept. But yeah, I feel really pleased with the team and everything we've developed because as you say, from the signatures of the car to the colors and materials, I think we've delivered what was there.
No gull wings, but...
No gull wings. That was a bit extreme. I think everyone knew that was just to sort of showcase the interior, clean up the aperture so everyone could photograph inside. But that was very show car-y.
And the interior on this car is great.
The interior is a big deal. I think, we've put in enough elegance and beauty in the exterior, but of course it's still a very functional, capacious machine. But the interior is actually a bigger deal for me because it's really about the sensibilities of Lincoln Interiors going forward.
Mm-hmm. David, if somebody just stepped onto the planet, never heard of Lincoln before, and saw these different brands, how would you describe to them the way that you've evolved the design? What is the direction? What are you trying to do with it?
Yeah, so I'd always caveat everything with, an illustrious past that we had. We had these beautiful, iconic cars in the 50s and 60s. And I think what you're seeing with the brand essence and what we're striving to achieve now is actually just finding our true center again. So we talk about quiet luxury. We don't want to be the brashest on the block. We don't want to talk about brake horsepower and performance figures in that kind of arms race that everyone else is in. We want to be about something else. And I think there's a lot of customers out there who actually appreciate what we're trying to do now about quiet luxury, about serene interiors, about exteriors that are about elegance and beauty.
When I look at so many other luxury cars, they look aggressive, I think is the word I'd use. And when I look at your designs, I would say soothing.
Yeah, that's great that you say that, John, because, I mean, that is what we're aiming for. I think the competitors are in the world of attack, and we want to personify seduction. So I think really we want to get back to that beauty and allure and elegance and seduce the customer with what we do.
So in some regards, you guys are an outlier then?
I think we're actually being pretty brave, Gary, in what we're doing now. And I think it's starting to bear fruit. I think we're just setting a good bar and a good standard with Continental and Navigator. And from here, it's just going to keep getting better,
So how would you describe the design language that is Lincoln's design language today?
So there's a couple of key aspects. One is, as I said, we want our exteriors to be beautiful, and that's qualified by elegance. And the interiors, we want to be a place of sanctuary and calmness and serenity. We want the interiors to really transcend people's lives, that you get into a Lincoln and you don't feel a hustle and bustle, you feel a calmness and equilibrium that really takes you out of the normal to this very special place. And, something I talk a lot about with my team is about underscoring the horizontal. That's a kind of...
What do you mean by underscoring horizontal?
Yeah, so it's a design philosophy of every opportunity, or if we take a thematic on the exterior or the interior, it will always lie this way. I think it's very fundamental, back to human nature, that, when you go on vacation, you walk down to the beach and you see the horizon line of the ocean, you get this feeling of calmness and beauty. And it's exactly that. We want to instill that same feeling on the interior. So, a great example would be the transmission selector. So we on the previous cars, we've had a vertical stack of buttons, and we've taken that and we've laid it horizontally. And this is more about, an influence from piano keys. It's imbuing a sense of beauty, elegance, and humanity.
What is it? Because you're absolutely right. When you look at that vertical strip, park, reverse, neutral, drive, on a vertical, it doesn't look elegant per se. And when you lay it out horizontally, it just looks more sophisticated. Why is that?
It's these innate human qualities. As I say, back to that view of the ocean and looking at the beach. I think it's also, back to that lower, longer, leaner is more beautiful. It's just innate in us.
Another thing I'd love you to talk about is we shot one of our television shows looking all about high-end audio systems that are in cars today, which sound phenomenal. But one of the things that came up is when you guys did, I think it was on the Continental, these beautiful speaker grills, with this dot pattern or hole pattern. And the audio guys went in there and went, nah, that doesn't work. And yet... you guys were able to create a pattern that still looks good and I guess works from an audio standpoint.
Yeah, so there's a few things we know for the luxury customer is really important. The comfort of the seat, so we really emphasize that on the new Lincolns, and the sound of the sound system inside. So we work very closely with Harman, with their Revel system, on, you know, not just the pattern of the mesh, but, you know, and it's exactly the size of the holes and the pattern of them. But also the position of them. You know, there's so many speakers on our interiors, and we position those to get the perfect sound inside.
That's got to be a real challenge as a designer, as you do these beautiful things, and then the engineers come in and go, nah, that ain't going to work.
Yeah, I mean, one of a lot of challenges, John. We have it on, you know, on so many fronts, right? But that's, you know, that's our job. We got to work with those and make the best of it. Mm-hmm.
So you're emphasizing the interior of the vehicle. I mean, are you guys benchmarking, say, furniture design versus automotive seating designs and things like that? I mean, the other amenities that go on.
I wouldn't say we do look at our competitors and we do benchmarking, but I would say the inspiration comes from the brand essence, the design vision, from a lot of research on the customer, like observational research. So, you know, we pay particular attention to what the customers need and want, and also what they don't know they need. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, care and attention to the design on every touch point with the customer is really important. So we spend a lot of time, you know, talking about it and really trying to envision, like, these very important touch points, you know.
So, I mean, in some ways, you know, I mean, I said outlawer before, but I mean, it's almost like you guys are a challenger brand in this segment, and you're saying, you know what, we're going to compete on our doing things, not only this more serene approach, but a level up in terms of the materials that were being used, the amenities that are being offered, as well as the services that are beyond what you guys do. But is that a fair statement?
I think it is, and I hope it is. I think the Lincoln team these days is very thoughtful, very considered, and I think, you know, throughout the organization, we try and, you know, really put ourselves in the place of the customer and think, what do they need and want? And in fact, how can we surpass that and go beyond just sort of the most practical, but into the most beautiful? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Navigator that we've got here, we put a lot of care and attention into what we call the ultra-luxury touch points. And it's like everything you come into contact with on this interior, we try to elevate to another level.
Mm-hmm. I think there's probably more room to go in that direction, in the sense that, you know, Gary and I get to test drive all these luxury cars and their technological tour de forces. I'm not sure the customer even knows how much capability is in their car and are not even going to use it. And so putting more investment and time and attention into the interior, I think, could pay off even better.
Yeah, and I think just presenting the customer with what they need and what they can find. As you say, you know, I think there's layers that they don't even know is there, that are there. So I think we have to be very thoughtful and intuitive about, you know, the best way of presenting that beautiful content and do it very thoughtfully.
Mm-hmm. I thought one of the interesting things to learn about the Navigator is that actually it's a very young buyer. And so how did you address the interests of a younger person with luxury?
Yeah, so it is a surprise. I mean, the Navigator nameplate is actually our most recognized, and it's younger because of young families. And Navigator, although it's, you know, we invented that segment of the, you know, full-size luxury segment, but it's actually a very practical need, you know, about families and everything they need with them. So we know that protection of their loved ones is very important to them. There's a certain amount of that that's just naturally imbued in that scale of product. But I think, you know, throughout the product, we've gone through it, Gary, with that in mind, you know, of great functionality, trying to imbue a sense of elegance with the exterior, even though it's so capacious and accommodating.
Mm-hmm. Very good. David Woodhouse, we're going to have to wrap this segment up. Thanks so much for stopping by. I really appreciate your
pleasure.
Time. Love talking with you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Gary.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break. We got a lot more to talk about, but right now we're going to give a shout-out to our friends from Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
We're back from the floor of the New York Auto Show. Gary and I are now joined by our august panel, including Jim Henry, freelancer who does a lot of work with Automotive News, Forbes, and others, and Sam Fiorani, who's with Auto Forecast Solutions, which is always forecasting what kind of new products are coming out in the business.
Good job.
Great having the both of you guys here.
Well, thanks.
And this is the part of the show where we've got to go to Dr. Data.
Okay.
Gary, what's the number?
13,587. Okay, and so we'll make it a little bit more localized by saying it has something to do with where we're at.
You mean Javits Center or New York City?
New York City.
13,000. What was that?
13,587.
Taxi cabs?
Oh, my God. Wow.
So it's the number of yellow cabs in New York City as of this past January.
I bet it was a lot more 5 years ago.
It was a lot more 5 years ago, and there are a lot fewer Ubers and Lyft cars 5 years ago. Probably none.
I've heard that there's more Ubers in Manhattan than yellow cabs.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Especially in the boroughs, if you include the outer boroughs. The youngsters that I work with, you know, they wouldn't consider taking a yellow taxi. You talk about taking a taxi, and they look at you like, oh, you poor old guy. Isn't that cute? He wants to take a taxi. It's pretty universal.
And John and I took a lift last night. So.
Yeah, exactly. We're not that old yet.
But it's those poor taxi drivers who bought the medallions years ago for $500,000 or more.
No, a million.
Yeah.
I want to say if you go back to around 2010, medallions were still $1 million. What are they now?
Price is coming down.
A quarter of a million?
Yeah.
Which is still a ripoff when you think about it. I mean, how do you as a taxi cab driver compete against Uber and Lyft drivers who don't have to shell out that kind of money?
Right.
And, you know, in the past, they would gladly pay $1 million or whatever the price was because they knew when they'd retire, they'd sell the medallion for that much more money.
Franchise.
It was like buying a house, you know. They had equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People were basing their retirement on that. You know, that was the whole point. My kids will live on what I sell the medallion for.
Right. But, I mean, I think it goes to the point of how this industry is being transformed in a very short period of time. I mean, as you said, 5 years ago, there would be so many more yellow cabs than there are now. So 5 years hence, I mean, the question becomes, all right, does this change private ownership of vehicles? Do more people just say, you know what, I'm going to be part of the ride-hailing or ride-sharing community? And what happens to cars as we know them?
Well, the problem with that viewpoint is that it's a West Coast, East Coast thing. It's a major city thing. Once you get outside of a major metropolitan area, you have to own a car. There's no ride hailing in the smaller cities, especially in the rural areas. If you live near farmland in central Pennsylvania, you're going to have a car because you have to get to the next city to go grocery shopping. Pickup truck usually, yes. But you'll need a vehicle to get to town to get something for work. You need your own vehicle.
I would agree in rural, real rural, spread out, the next farm's a mile down the road kind of a thing. But I think even in the suburbs that this whole ride-sharing, car-sharing thing is really going to catch on in time.
Right.
I'm not saying overnight, but...
The industry has a lot of catching up to do, too. You know, I write about the finance aspect of the industry a lot, and the lenders are very concerned that they're putting out loans on cars that are going to be used for an Uber car, and it doesn't appear that way in their actuarial tables. You know, it's like when they're toting up losses and mileage and like that, they're unpleasantly surprised to find that it's an Uber car.
That is an interesting point, Jim, because
insurance companies too.
Because a lease is based on what you think the residual value is going to be, and if all of a sudden they're racking up 80,000 miles a year instead of 10,000 to 15,000, you bet that would affect the residual value.
There are a lot of guys in green eye shades trying to figure out ways to identify those units, you know.
Well, one of the things that I think about, though, is we heard from Randy Parker earlier in the show about how the New York area is his number one market for Infiniti, and Los Angeles being number two. Now, to your point, Sam, that you know, when you get out of the cities, the rural areas, you still need to have vehicle ownership. But what happens when more and more of the cities turn to the, you know, ride hailing and ride sharing apps? What happens to companies like Infiniti?
Well, you know, this is everything that the industry is worried about, but the impact hasn't been felt yet.
Right.
But I don't think there's any question that this is my opinion. I don't think we're going to need as many cars in the future. Or maybe I should state it another way. I saw somebody that was doing a projection as to where global car sales were going. And by like 2040, let me back up one step. Right now, this year, we'll probably sell 100 million new vehicles globally, more or less. They're saying by 2040, it's going to go to 400 million. And I'm thinking, I don't think the planet can take it. I mean, congestion's bad enough as it is. I just don't see that level of sales happening.
But you have to look at developing nations that don't have any cars or very few cars. You know, large portions of Africa, parts of South America, parts of Asia that don't have any cars or virtually any cars on the road. So you have room to grow. It's like telling Subaru you have the South to grow because you don't sell any cars
in the
South.
I've been in Asia, I've been in South America, and I've seen some of the most horrific traffic jams there as I have anywhere like
right,
here.
Right. But to your point about Infiniti in New York, people in New York don't typically have driver's license. I heard a story from a woman who worked for one of the locally based magazines about 20 years ago, and we asked her, how did you get this job? And they said, well, the editor brought us in and said, who has a driver's license? And she raised her hand. She was the only one, so she became the automotive editor of that magazine, simply because she had a license. People in New York, it's different in L.A., but people in New York typically don't need a car. They mm-hmm. don't want a car. They don't even have a driver's license.
Right.
So the co-ownership of a vehicle, or even ride-hailing, is more important here as opposed to L.A., where you would own a car, and that would take away from car ownership if there was co-ownership of a car.
Right. Although it's interesting to see, I mean, as we drive around in New York and to see the number of luxury vehicles that are out there. And I have a feeling that if I can afford to get an Infiniti or a Lexus or a Mercedes or any of these other marks, that I'm probably not going to share it with someone. It's probably going to be mine.
Yeah, and I also heard the argument at the conference yesterday.
This is the NADA, the National Auto
NADA
Dealers
and
Association.
J.D. Power, yeah. That the co-ownership is not necessarily one-to-one going to reduce the number of cars that people own because, for instance, if your 9-year-old needs a ride to the soccer game, you know, now you got to get in your car and take them. But if they can take an Uber, then that's somebody else's car. So now it's two cars on the road. So it's not necessarily always going to be a net reduction in the number of units in operation.
Well, or on the road at least.
Right.
And to your point about jacking up the mileage, you're going to wear them out, so the cars are going to get turned over faster. And so even with cars today being 11 years on the road and having more mileage and being more reliable for a longer period of time, they're still going to turn them over faster. So you're going to need to replace them, so the sales and production will still remain high.
Jim, the conference you went to, being NADA and J.D. Power, but NADA especially, a lot of dealership attendance, a lot of participation. Was this coming up in any of the conversations?
It came up a lot. I would say that what we're seeing now is the very thin edge of the wedge, you know, and the question is, does it take the expression they kept using was, does it become shaped like a hockey stick where all of a sudden it really begins to take off, and at what point does that happen? But I think the general feeling was, what we're witnessing now is still the very thin edge of the woods in terms of ride sharing and like that. I mean, nobody wants to be behind on the subject, but I don't think dealers are quaking in their boots about it for sure.
So do auto manufacturers begin to think in the context of, okay, as we're developing new vehicles, we need to develop them taking into account the fact that these may be vehicles that are not used for just personal ownership, but for ride-sharing purposes?
You have to stay in the business, but what adaptations would you see that you would need to have? You know, what is in a car today that you would need in
interiors
a lift car?
Interiors you can hose out.
That would be good.
Well, actually, automakers do that to a degree. There are taxi packages. There are police car packages. In fact, I was talking to somebody from Toyota that said the engineers in Japan were horrified to hear that Priuses were being used as taxis in New York City, because they said, but that's not the taxi cab spec Prius. Right. And it was just like, so what? You know, we're just using it this way. But yeah, I think to your point, you're going to have to design for that. So, you know, Ford is experimenting right now with ride sharing in San Francisco with Chariot is the name of the brand that they're using. They're using Transit Connects,
The
big transit vans. But one of the things they are looking at in about 4 or 5 years' time is coming out with a specifically designed transit van that's, you know, to that taxi spec or police car spec, or in this case, ride-sharing spec.
But those typical police and taxi are just heavier-duty drivetrains.
Right.
Is there anything to the interior of the vehicle that you would have to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you...
A police spec interior is hose-outable.
Right. Yeah, but look at, you know, the Crown Vic. I mean, there was a spec just for the vinyl that they used on the seats.
Right. Yeah.
It was, you know, there was no carpeting in those cars. It was all big, thick rubber mats. And that's what I mean of getting to that spec. The alternator's heavier duty. The brakes are, the exhaust, blah, 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 blah. They do things that they know these are the items that are going to wear out the fastest,
right,
or not stand up to the abuse.
Not really my area, but I learned the buzzword of upfitters. Mm-hmm. For commercial vans, and they can take a spec van and turn it into anything, you know, a specialist for, you know, plumbers and all kinds of specific professions like that, and maybe they need something like that for passenger cars too. I'm sure it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
But there's only but so many fixed points within the car. You know, they could probably do a lot. You know, Nissan worked for years and years trying to come up with the taxi cab of tomorrow,
right,
here in New York City. And it might not be representative because it's so heavily regulated here, but oh my God, it went on for years and years before they could finally get the specs approved, and then somebody protested it and back and forth. It took 7 or 8 years before they could finally got settled on a package, and still I don't think they're hellaciously popular.
Mm-hmm.
With all due respect, I'm sure it's a terrific taxi cab, but it's like herding cats trying to get everybody to settle on a specific specification.
Yeah.
Well, so here we are at an auto show where private ownership is still the key. So you guys are from this part of the world, more or less. What is characteristic about the New York show versus Detroit or Chicago or Los Angeles?
Well, this being closer to the dealers than and farther away from the industry itself, it's. I did see Mark Royce walking around here, but you see fewer of the big wigs from Detroit walking around here, and it's more tailored to Manhattanites and New York City people and selling the products that they would want to see here. Whereas in Detroit, you'll see global introductions of globally important cars. Usually here, it's something more tailored to East Coast or specifically New York.
And so what would that be? I mean, give me an example of that.
Well, the Subaru introduction here, the three-row 7 or 8 passenger vehicle is more of a family vehicle and more of an American product.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Detroit, you might see a more globally product. And Subaru being local, being based in New Jersey.
Right.
It's more of a hometown thing.
So the Ascent, I think it was a concept, though, that they didn't...
Although they did say the production one will be called the Ascent as well.
It's edging pretty close, I think, to the final.
So it's more of a production intent car than a concept
car.
Yeah.
It was so close, though. They just changed the door handles, and it's the production car.
Yeah,
that's why I don't like the trend of what they call concept cars these days. They pull the door handles off. Maybe they put on skinny mirrors, and they call it a concept, and... That's not a concept. That's just an excuse to show you a vehicle at different shows and claim that it's the world debut.
Yeah.
But my experience with the public days at the New York show is it's a very retail-oriented show. I mean, people come here and slam the trunks and close the doors and you know, climb up underneath there and do everything you would do in a showroom. I was pretty surprised, having only gone to the press days, to come here when the public is here. It's very retail oriented, and it leads to a lot of sales. The dealer association would be all over that topic. You know, they've done all kinds of research that shows a bump in sales following the auto show.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we got to talk more about what we saw on the floor here, the vehicles that we saw, and get those opinions. But we got to take a quick break right now, and we're going to be back talking about what we really think of what's going on at the New York Auto Show.
There's only one talk show that covers the issues and executives that drive the auto industry. Turn to AutoLine This Week, every Friday at AutoLine.tv or on your local PBS stations across America. AutoLine This Week. You can't get more inside the industry.
We're back at the New York Auto Show. Gary and I are being joined by Jim Henry and Sam Fiorani. And so, Gary, what'd you like on the floor of the show today?
I think the Toyota concept, the FT4X.
Very good. I'm stumbling over that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the small...
son of FJ Cruiser. Son of
that, exactly, yeah. I think that... I think we're going to see this car.
I don't
know how Toyota can let that small crossover segment escape it, and they're going to do something. I mean, we heard from Bill Fay, who was being very coy about this, but, you know... How can they not?
Was that the one that's sort of an urban car?
The off-road, get to the trailhead. You know, they had a variety of accessories, a center cushion that was a North Face sleeping bag that you'd pull out and use it, and they showed tents that you can have back there and so on and so forth.
Removable lights.
I mean, I don't think that we're going to see all of that. But I think what we're going to see is they're going to get into this, you know, this B segment crossover, and I'm sure that they're going to have a four-wheel drive vehicle there.
It was a great concept, and they really touted all the things it could do, pulling this out and using this multiple different ways. It was great. The refrigerator and the hot door and in the rear doors was great, but it didn't do anything for me personally. But I posted a picture of it on Twitter, and it's just blowing up. So other people like it.
Right.
And so that's my judgment more than my decisions. If anyone else likes it, it's going to go into production.
Yeah, I think it was really well done.
I like that one, too. In fact, I didn't know that it was coming here. And we always talk about this every car show, that whichever automaker keeps something as a surprise and springs it typically tends to be the hit of the show.
Although there was a hit of the show that they'd been teasing relentlessly for weeks and weeks and weeks, which was the Dodge Demon that we saw last night. And man, did that thing ever make an impact.
Yeah, that was probably the most spectacular, over-the-top, total showbiz kind of a new car introduction that I've ever seen at any car show.
Ever.
Yeah. No, I mean, this was, I'm saying this was Hollywood and Vegas and Broadway all wrapped up into a new car introduction.
Well, it's kind of the new old Chrysler tradition, right? They used to have, you know, the leapfrogging minivans and crash through the wall and all those things. Here in New York, they did a lot of those sort of famous intros.
They did, and this is very much in that. But those intros that you're talking about were always on the floor of the show. This was off-site.
Yeah, that's really a thing.
And, I mean, they had all kinds of celebrities, and then Vin Diesel was there, and I think I saw Michael Strahan and a bunch of others, and they had a bunch of the beautiful people there as well. And
John and I.
It wasn't me, I can assure you. No, the models is what I'm talking about, men and women. And it was jam-packed, and it was pyrotechnics, and it was loud music, and it was, I mean, concussions from explosions going off. It was lighting up one of these demons, pulling a wheelie, and it wasn't, I'm not talking about something that went for 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, it must have been, almost a half hour long of this.
Yeah, so it was an amazing vehicle, and you know, you're talking about how your Twitter feed got lots of hits from the result of showing that Toyota. Everybody that I've talked to has said that the phenomenal number of hits they're getting showing that demon is just you know. But I mean, was it 840 horsepower?
Right, up to 840 horsepower.
Yeah. 160 in 2.3 seconds. I mean, that's fast.
So we thought it was crazy when they had the Hellcat. Okay, right. What was that? 707 horsepower.
Just 707.
Yeah. And I mean, in this, I mean, so what's the deal? I mean, does Dodge think that there's going to be a lot of customers for that car?
No, because I wasn't at the introduction, but I had been told that it only had one seat, only had a driver's seat.
Yeah, they'll sell you the other one for $1. That's what right. Tim Kuniskis said.
Yeah, and it has basically racing slicks in the back and narrow tires up front. You're going to drive this on your commute?
No, I don't care. The narrow tires come in a box that's in the trunk with a whole bunch of other things. So when right. you get to the track, you pull out the box, you got your tires, you got a fuel can, you got a bunch of other things.
The toolbox that you can buy with it.
Yeah, I haven't heard what the price
is. Called AAA.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, you get to the track and you set it up to go drag racing, and then you put everything back on and drive it home. But, yeah, why did they do this? I think the real reason they did it is Dodge has nothing. Nothing. You know, the Journey is an old vehicle. The Caravan is as old as the hills.
Right, Caravan's going away.
Cherokee, or the Challenger and the Charger are the only things else pretty much that they've got.
Durango.
Durango, but the Durango's old. So how do you keep the Dodge name vibrant?
And just cars in general are looking kind of fey lately. At least that's a lot of the buzz. I think that should be taken with a grain of salt. But, you know, what do cars do that trucks don't do? And that's largely performance. So if you want to light a fire under cars, that would be how to do it, I guess.
But what have you guys seen?
Well, there's the Subaru that we mentioned, the Ascent, which I think is the vehicle they've needed for years. You
know,
the Tribeca didn't hit the market. Subaru buyers buy Subarus. They buy them for generations. And as they grow older and get more in their family, they're going to need three seats, four seats for kids. You need that third row. And so this one's available with up to eight seats. And I think it's more accessible than the Tribeca design was. The people I know who've had Tribecas loved them, but it was a niche group.
Okay, is the thing I wonder about Subaru, I mean, their sales have been going up, but it's almost as though they started out as a cult brand. I mean, there was a very core
Absolutely.
Group that bought Subarus. Okay, at what point is it too big and therefore it loses some of its panache?
It's coming close, but I still think they have virtually half the country they haven't touched yet. Subaru is a northern company. They've sold in the Rust Belt for 50 years now. And it's because of the front-wheel drive and because of the all-wheel drive. It's just been northern buyers. They still have the south part of the country to sell and to tap into. They still have a while to go.
I think they've got a lot of headroom myself because I've got two family members that have bought Subarus. I mean, and they're new to the brand. They were never in the brand before. So if I see people like that stepping into the brand, I'm telling you, there's a lot more people that could do it, provided they have the right product.
Oh, absolutely. And their products have been getting great over the past three, four generations of their vehicles. You know, they show the 360 over here, and you can see where they came from.
The old 1968 360.
Yes, that's a classic. But when you see it next to the other ones, it's the size of a spare tire compared to the rest of the car. It's just a tiny little thing. And there's four seats in it.
Jim, did you see any car or pick up on anything on the show that stands out?
I thought every brand now has SUVs. You know, every brand, the luxury brands, even Maserati, Jaguar. I don't know right off the top of my head whether Rolls-Royce has an SUV. Maybe they might.
It's coming.
Yeah, it's coming.
Yeah. See, so and we're seeing small, medium, large, extra large, extra, extra large, extra small, extra, extra small SUVs and crossovers. I mean, that's really beginning to branch out, I think. And so there's maybe room to run there on that trend. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as sort of more mass market, more commercially attractive cars, I liked the Navigator. I thought it had a lot of presence, which is something that people like that buy those want. You look at it and just go, holy smokes, that is really big. And I think Subaru maybe gets a little bit of that too with the Ascent, which is not something they've really had. They've always been just sort of, I think of them as hush puppy shoes of cars. And having a three-row SUV, I think, is going to help.
Absolutely. They're using the show for the Genesis crossover introduction as well, and I haven't seen it yet, but it's everybody has to touch that market. It's where the market, and to your point about cars going away, the classic Chrysler brands currently have three cars, and the 300s days are numbered. So you have the Charger and the Challenger left in the car lineup for that whole brand, all those brands.
Do you think they'll invest in another passenger car?
There's a next generation Charger and Challenger coming, okay. But beyond that, there's nothing set for North America.
If Fiat's got one, they may, but yeah.
Yeah, everything else would be imported.
If you had to grow one here, I don't know if it would make sense.
Yeah. They have the Dodge Neon in Mexico that they're importing from Turkey at the moment.
We had Steve Senner on the show from Honda a couple of weeks ago when he brought the fuel cell Clarity. Now, they filled out their line today by showing the full EV and the plug-in hybrid version. Now, here's Honda making a bet, A, on alternative electrified powertrains, and B, on cars. So what do you guys make of that?
Honda's a car company. They've been making good small cars for 40, 50 years. And they're dipping their toe into the crossovers. The CR-V is the first or second most popular crossover in the country.
Right.
And the Pilot's doing very well. But the Element didn't do well. The Accord and the Civic are still top sellers. I think they think it's Prius ground. We have to get a car. And Kia looks at it and says, "Oh no, we'll bring out the Niro." And it's a crossover, and it has a great untapped market. I think crossing over the popular crossover with fuel economy. This is, my wife wants a minivan that's a hybrid. Until the Pacifica came out, nobody tapped that. Mm-hmm. There's been a 30-year minivan market, and nobody's put a battery in a minivan.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, what Honda's doing with the Clarity is all to do with government regulations. There's very little market demand for vehicles like this. As you point out, Gary, it's a passenger car. Even though Honda's strong in cars, I think that's going to be very hard. I don't think they're going to sell a whole lot of these things. I don't even think they're going to catch the Prius, which is clearly the leader in the green car segment. But if they do a couple of thousand a month, I'll be surprised. I don't see this thing selling much of anything.
I think they're somewhat California-centric, too. So maybe they're looking at things through more of a California lens than maybe we would normally be thinking.
Well, to a degree, Jim, though, but I mean, this is purely driven by government mandate.
Yeah,
government,
yeah.
U.S. government and California Air Resources Board mandate. But, I wonder how long can the industry keep doing this? I don't know of any other industry at all where government regulation forces you to build a product that you're going to lose money on. And none of them make money on even their hybrids, much less their plug-ins and battery electrics or fuel cells. I just don't think this is sustainable unless the Model 3 and the Chevy Bolt are the magic turning point where you can start to get the volume where you can make a return on this investment.
But what's interesting, though, is I think what Honda's doing and what then last week or the week before when we had Michael Bryan from Hyundai on and talking about the Ioniq, and in both cases, both companies are making three vehicles, different powertrains off the same platform so they can get production scale, which will help drive the cost down, at least of the basic vehicle itself. Now, the powertrain may not be less expensive, but, and going back to my 13,587 number, I mean, it is astonishing to see how many hybrid vehicles are taxicabs. And so you got to believe that these guys realize that this may be the way to go.
That's getting a real tailwind from regulation too. Certainly in New York City, it is.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a Bloomberg era thing. That they get a lot of breaks or incentives, I think, for doing hybrids.
In fact, going back to your earlier discussion about the Nissan Taxi of tomorrow, that was kind of one of the things that was a real sticking point for the city, is that they're not hybrids.
Yeah. And a big aspect of it, too, was that they're handicapped accessible, which is great, but maybe is exceeding the demand, mm-hmm. if they all have to be.
Mm-hmm. We saw the Buick showed the Regal in public here, I believe, the first
both of
showing
them.
Of the, yeah. Tell us about those cars.
Oh, no, I like the hatchback and the Tour X, and they're great cars, but the wagon is the Outback of 20 years ago.
So that's the Tour X, the wagon, and then
and the Sportback is the hatchback.
Sportback. So the Regal, historically just a three box, has now got a hatch rather than the trunk.
They're selling a sedan version in China, but the hatchback and the wagon come from Germany. Mm-hmm. And the hatchback is a four-door hatchback, and cars aren't selling. Hatchback cars aren't selling. They sell hatchbacks as crossovers now. Mm-hmm. And the hatchback is purely a car. The wagon is being touted as a crossover, but
it's a wagon.
It's a wagon.
So the thing is that, we've often said that, if it's a wagon with a diesel engine and a manual transmission, every journalist will buy it, but journalists don't buy cars. So.
That's right.
Yeah, that's another real car brand, is Buick.
Buick, yes.
And what cars they get, a lot of them are coming from Opel, and they don't own Opel anymore. And so
this is the last one.
There, yeah.
But walking around the Buick site, you realize how international Buick is.
That's true.
Because there's a Polish car, there's a German car, there are two German cars, there's a Chinese car, there's an American car.
What's the Polish car?
The convertible.
Cascada.
Oh, Cascada.
Yeah. But you walk around that lot and you're just like, it's every country that manufactures cars is represented here.
Wow. Hey guys, we're going to have to wrap this up. But Jim Henry, Sam Fiorani, thanks so much for stopping by. Really like having you guys on the show here.
Thanks
for having us.
And Gary, good seeing you here in New York, and let's do it again.
Absolutely, but think back in the studio.
Okay, we'll do that. I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.